Hi, everyone, and welcome to Focus Forward, an executive function podcast where we explore the challenges and celebrate the wins you'll experience as you change your life through working on improving your executive function skills. I'm your host, Hannah Choi.
It's a special day for us here at Focus Forward. Today marks our 40th episode, and it's just days ahead of our two-year podcast anniversary. I want to thank our amazing team at Beyond Booksmart and, of course, you, our listeners. Thank you so much for listening and downloading and sharing our podcast with your people. It really means so much to us to know that so many of you are finding the work that we're doing here at Focus Forward helpful. And today's episode is also really special because I had the ultimate privilege and joy of getting to sit down for a conversation with Ellen Galinsky. Ellen is the OG of researching and writing about executive function skills, parenthood, and child development. In addition to being the author of many, many books, she also founded the Families and Work Institute, along with a lot of other life accomplishments that you can read about in her bio. You may have heard of or read her book, Mind in the Making, which explores seven life skills that young kids need to thrive. And these life skills are executive function skills. In her books, she takes the brilliant work done by researchers all over the world and writes about it in a way that we non-researchers can understand and use in our lives. She's done the same with her new book, The Breakthrough Years, which is all about teenagers and comes out in a couple weeks on March 26th. The Breakthrough Years teaches us more than just how to help our teenagers thrive. It helps us understand them. And as you'll hear Ellen explain, she asked teenagers what they want people to know about them. The messages that teens want us adults to hear make up the five chapters of the book. First, understand our development. Next, listen and talk with us, not at us. Third is don't stereotype us. The fourth is we are trying to understand ourselves and our needs. And last but not least, we are drawn to learn life and learning skills. These messages show us adults how much we can learn from the adolescents in our lives. If you are ever a teen, have young kids who will become teens one day, or are raising teens right now, this book is for you. And if you're a teacher or any other kind of caregiver of teens, this book is also for you. And there are two other ideas that Ellen reinforces in the book that I think will be really helpful to remember as you're listening. First, she says, know that every day is a new day with your children, and it is never too late. And the next is that adversity is not destiny. It's really worth doing the work, as hard as it may be. And this has been true for me, and as you'll hear me share, it's a pretty powerful book in many ways, and I am just so excited for Ellen to share it with all of us, and that I get to be a part of that sharing. So, listen today to learn from Ellen. Now, on to the show. Hi, Ellen. Thank you so much for joining me on Focus Forward.
Hi, Hannah. It's wonderful to be with you.
Oh, I know. I've been so excited for this conversation for so long. And we got to chat on last week before we met, and it was just really lovely to meet you. And I'm just so excited about this book and about you bringing this book to the world. I think it is really needed. I know it's really needed. And it was really impactful for me to read it. And I just felt such an honor to be part of this. It's just so important to me as a person. So thank you. Thank you so much for the book, and thank you for being here.
What kind of impact did it have? When you're an author, you sit at your computer and you're writing a book and you have no idea
how
it's received. You of course have hopes and dreams, but what was the impact on you?
Well, it hit me in so many different directions, or not directions, but through so many different paths. First, as an executive function coach, I'm just interested in executive function skills and interested in supporting adolescents. So it's just the age group itself is really important to me. And of course, learning about EF skills is also really important to me too. But I think most deeply it hit me as a parent, because my kids are 12 and 15. And so they're really in this age that you're writing about, and that
that you gathered all that research about. And so the fact that I'm already interested in it, plus the fact that I'm just in it as a parent with kids this age, it was just, I remember when I got the letter, the email from from Jessica, I was just like, oh my goodness, yes, please, this is what I need in my life right now to satisfy the curiosity and also just satisfy just like that life experience that I'm li literally living right now. So yeah. So can you share a little bit with our listeners about kind of how you maybe got to where you are in order to be able to write this amazing book?
I think of myself as a research adventurer. My whole life, I've followed questions. I think since I was a little kid, and I was interested in, well, why do I have people have more dark cars this year than red cars? Or, I'd make up questions to make the time go by when I was waiting at a bus stop. I just always have been very curious and had questions that I don't think have necessarily easy answers, but I really want to know. And I think that the questions that I want to know about will help me and will help other people. It's not just selfishly will help me. So when I first had children, I got interested in the transition to parenthood and what that's like, and what do we do to help make that easy or hard for people. And then as I went back to work and had children, I got interested in why are people so negative about childcare? There has to be good childcare out there. So the first book was on the transition to parenthood called Beginnings. The second book was on childcare, and it was called The New Extended Family Daycare That Works. And then I got interested in how parents grow and change, and wrote a book on nobody had ever studied that. I'm always going into these very new lands where there's not a whole lot of markers and not a lot of guideposts to help you figure it out, which is what I particularly love. I love the adventure of it. And then after that, I kept hearing about work and family life from everyone. Everyone thought that they were the only one having trouble with their kids, getting them going in the morning, or having their kids argue with each other at the dinner table. It was, that everybody else's house was perfect, and they were the only people managing work and family life issues, men and women. I was hearing that from all over the world, and in research that I was doing in my job, and so. Helped to start the Families and Work Institute, and then wrote a book about work and family life. I also got interested in preschool kids and what the research says about their development. Later on, I was very interested in what do we do to keep the fire for burning brightly in children's eyes. So, wrote a book that didn't start out as a book. It was an accidental book. I was just interested in understanding what we as a society are doing to turn so many kids off from learning, because engagement in learning in school is low. And that led to the breakthrough years, where I had been studying early childhood on one side, and where I had been doing a series of studies where we ask young people about how they feel about the burning issues in their lives. On the other side, I'd done a series of studies and even a book about that. So the breakthrough years was really the questions of what can we do to help adolescents, kids from 9 on as they go into puberty, both learn and thrive. That was my question.
I'm so glad you asked all those questions and then actually did something about it. So thank you.
Well, I don't want to do research that just sits on a shelf. I mean, I do research, but I don't want it to be an academic paper or an academic book or something that is not going to be a living, breathing response. I practice a form of research called civic science, which means that nothing about us without us is one way of saying it. So if I'm doing a study about something, I ask people who would be the subjects of a study, what they want to know. So I started with young people and wanted to ask them and did ask them, what do you want to know about your development? And I asked them, I'm going to talk to researchers about adolescence. What should I be asking them? And I wanted to know if they had one wish to improve the lives of people their age, what would it be? And I wanted to know what they thought adults should know about people their age. But I took my grandson with me and a friend of his too.
Oh, cool.
Antonio was just graduating from college. It was the summer after college. And this was a chance for me not only to listen as myself, but to have two young men listen with me to hear what they heard. And that was so cool. I mean, we would be up, you know, in these endless conversations about, well, he heard this, but I didn't hear it that way.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, it was wonderful to have a young person with me. And I had a young man who was just starting his PhD, really literally started with me in 2015 when I started this book, Brandon Olmey. And he traveled this whole 9 years now with me too.
Wow.
So that he is a researcher. He's now got his postdoc. He's done a postdoc. But he's also... was representing young people too. And it was just a chance to look at the research and listen to what we were hearing from people in when we were interviewing them in open-ended interviews to hear his take and my take.
I just love that. I recently interviewed the inclusive design team at Microsoft, and that's how inclusive design is done, with all the co-creators of what you're trying to improve. You absolutely have to include the people that you're studying, the people that you are creating products for. So I loved that when I read that in your book.
Well, and it takes you in a different direction than you thought you would go. I mean,
yeah.
That's why I call it a journey. If I just had looked at the research on adolescent development, I would have followed a very different path.
Right.
I listened to young people about what they wanted to know and what they wanted us adults to know.
Yeah. Very different. Yeah. And I loved how one of the chapters was don't stereotype us. And then I asked my son the same, you know, same kind of question. I said, what do you want people to know about kids your age? And he said, we're not all like the people that you see on TikTok or in the news. We're not all like that. Only some of us are like that. Don't think that we're all like that. And I was like, bingo.
38%. I mean, this was a nationally representative study, and 38% of young people from all over the country, they don't know each other. You know, this is, again, a random sample of young people. And they wrote, some of us, but not all of us.
Yeah.
We're not all addicted to our phones. We're not all like the people on TikTok. We're not all spoiled or indulged, you know, or we're not all snowflakes. That's rude, one person wrote. Or
that's cute.
You know, some of us have mental health problems, but not all of us do. You need to understand that there's a lot of difference, and don't put us all in one big generational group. Don't say we're the anxious generation, we're the COVID generation, we're the this generation. There's a lot of difference among us.
That reminds me of something else that was just a real theme throughout the whole book, was changing, and what you've already mentioned is changing our perspective on this age group and the experience of being a person in that age group, like going through your teenage years, going through your early, you know, or young adult ages. One thing that was really interesting that I thought was when the adults around a child have a more positive perspective on kids, on teenagers, on adolescents, then those kids have better outcomes. I thought that was really interesting.
You know, we think it's kind of jokey to say snarky things about kids, you know, and I can understand, you know, I've been very tempted to say, oh, stop being such a teenager, get over it, you know, or you're a hormonal mess, or any of the things that adults say. But it actually makes a difference. And the way that I know that is I ask parents for one word or phrase to describe the teen brain, not their own kid, but the generic, you know, what do you think of the teen brain or the adolescent brain? And only 14% of parents used positive words, which was heartbreaking, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so culturally okay to think that they're a mess. And
Yeah.
we wouldn't talk about other groups that way. But it matters. It's not just jokey. I found that when parents use negative words, and I could statistically control for their own words that they used about their own child, take out any negative words that they used about their own child, because I ask an open-ended question about that. I could take out any conflict that the parent or the child reported between each other, so they weren't just fighting all of the time. I could take out statistically demographics, so I could control for those sorts of things. And I could take out 9 months of time. I could look at how this affected kids 9 months later, which happened to be during the pandemic, and found that those parents who used negative words had kids who were sad or lonely or more depressed, more anxious, those kinds of negative words. They had more negative feelings. They were less engaged in school, even with all of those statistical controls. And other research shows that our conceptions of adolescence matter. So this is not, it's not really trivial. If we can sort of shift our frame and see what's good about them, what's hopeful about them, whether the possibilities about this age group, we're going to have a very different generation that is going to inherit the world.
Yeah, it reminds me when I read that part, it reminded me so much of a very vivid memory I have from when I was younger. I think I was, I don't know, 8 maybe or something, and I was in the car and we drove by some teenagers, and I remember thinking, I don't ever want to become a teenager because I think it rains every day. And I just thought that being a teenager was going to be this really horrible existence. And I didn't love being a teenager, but it didn't rain every day. Didn't end up as being as horrible as I thought. But I think it still impacted me as a parent as I headed into being the parent of preteens and then teenagers. I found myself thinking like, oh my God, is it going to rain every day as a parent of of this age group? And it's not. It's sunny most days.
It is sunny,
So.
and that's when we looked at the level of conflict as reported by parents and as reported by kids, we found that most days were sunny days. There wasn't as much conflict as we think.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a fight with your kid, it can loom large. So I'm not dismissing how big
Yes.
that is, but
Yes.
our, you know, 61% of us have been warned, just wait until they're a teenager,
Yeah.
from the time our children are little. So no
Yeah.
wonder, you know, I when I was writing this book, a person posted on social media, you know, she swore and then said puberty, and she got like 100 condolences within a few hours. They were funny, you know, like drink wine and barricade yourself and don't poke the bear, and they were funny, but they're just, we set up this dread of being the parent of a teenager, and understand why. I mean, there are reasons why we do this. We're afraid for them. You know, they're moving out on their own. It's a scary time, but it doesn't help us be the best parent we can.
And it just made me think about like the whole idea of priming our brain. So if we like prime ourselves to think a certain way, then we will think that way. And we're going to notice the more negative things if we're negatively primed. So if we grow up thinking that it's cloudy every day when you're a teenager, and then, we head into the parenthood of teens thinking this, then yeah, we're going to probably end up seeing the more negative stuff.
So I said I was writing the book at this time. You know, I was doing the research on this, and the kids had immediately said to me, "Why do people hate teenagers?" I mean, that was what they said in those interviews that Antonio and I did. Why do people hate teenagers? And so I said, "So, Zay, why do you think that they're called meanagers?" You know, and he says, "I guess because they're mean." You know, and then you look at the cultural icons, you know, the queen bees and wannabes, and they exist. There's no question that there can be mean kids, but you know, or kids behaving meanly, but there aren't mean kids. You know, it's
Yes,
behavior.
yes.
But But still, Zay was not like you, was not looking, you know, it's all those years later, and my grandson wasn't looking forward to being a teenager because he thought that somehow or other you magically became mean.
Yeah. So thinking about these, like these perspectives or assumptions or something that we make about teenagers, we may go in feeling like, oh, they're going to have a really hard time. What can I do to protect them from that? We might see them having really big emotions. We know that they're still young, so maybe they haven't learned how to deal with it yet. So it can be tempting to try to protect them from that. But what the research shows, and what your book really supports is this idea that we need to support our kids in becoming autonomous and independent and being learning to trust themselves and make decisions. And so when we try to make everything easier for them so they don't have to go through that sort of storm and stress of being a teenager, we don't really give them a lot of opportunities to learn the things.
I want to start with how we talk to kids when they're acting in the way that we think is like the stereotypical teenager, because we can be dismissive. We can say, "Oh, stop acting like such a teenager," or "Grow up," or "Get over it," or "I went through it. It's no big deal," or you know those sorts of things. And a lot of these, again, these are anonymous. I was asking in one question young people for one wish that would improve the lives of people their age. This was, you know, no prompting. And young people wrote in not to dismiss their feelings. It doesn't mean that we have to take them, we have to burst into tears and take them so endlessly seriously when they have, as you called it, big feelings. But I think not to say, yes, you are going to react more strongly to things, than younger kids and older kids. Because that's just the part of the hormonal changes going on in your body. You're going to feel things more deeply, and you're supposed to, because how else, when you go out into the world, will you know whether you're safe or not? You need to be able to react quickly. You need to be able to react strongly. You need to be able to, if someone is mean to you or disses you or that sort of thing, that's just part of development in every species and every culture. That's normal. And so, to really take it, you know, to say, "I understand," in a way that isn't just, "I understand, now get over it," but "I really do understand." And you might feel that way now. You won't always feel that way, but right now you feel that way. So let's then figure out how to deal with it. The other issue is that we can't fix things for kids. And I think it's a simple message, but it's hugely important. Young people, I mean, I think starting with very young children, so I don't think this is just about adolescents, we all need to be able to gain the skills to handle problems for ourselves and not feel that we can't solve problems and fix things for ourselves. So often in our attempts to make life easier, to protect our kids, to make it work better, to get through the day when we're busy and crazy and have work to do ourselves, we'll fix things for kids, but then we're not doing them any favors that way, because the task of life is to learn to resolve issues for themselves. I, as you know, think that executive function or executive function based skills are critically important. There's endless research that shows that these particular skills of the brain, they're very cognitively, you know, they're the boss of the brain, the orchestra conductor of the brain, the air traffic controller of the brain, these whatever analogy you want to use, these brain-based skills that we develop are the biggest predictor of academic success, life success, even health and wealth. So one of the skills that is based on executive function is called taking on challenges, in my view. And I think that what we need to do is to help young people, particularly in adolescence, figure out how to deal with it if someone has been mean. Don't just say ignore them or don't pay any attention to them or those sorts of things. Work with them to come up with a plan for how they're going to deal with the things that happen when you're an adolescent. They happen when you're an adult too. You're in a workplace environment, and People always don't behave perfectly. So these are skills that we need in life, not just when we're in middle school or in high school, but helping kids learn them and reading books about how different kids handled them, sharing your own experience about how you handle it, but the experience of someone else so that they see options. I mean, you can parent in autonomy supportive ways without actually stepping in and fixing it for children. That when you build on the need that we all have for autonomy, and I know this from the research that I have done for years on the workforce and workplace, that research is very clear that people who have feel they have some say, I don't mean endless control, I mean some say over how they do their work, how they live their lives, are healthier. And so autonomy is, with the right amount of demands and support in the literature on the workforce and workplace is very strong. It's the same for kids growing up. We need to help children learn through being autonomy supportive.
This is just hitting me deeply because it just brings up the idea of trust, and we have to trust our kids, and our kids have to learn to trust themselves, and they can't learn to trust themselves if they are never given the opportunity to learn to trust themselves. And we just found out recently that our son has anxiety and inattentive ADHD, which we knew the ADHD. I didn't realize that the anxiety was such a big piece of it, and I also didn't realize how low his self-esteem is. And now that I have that piece of the puzzle, I can look at him and see how so much of it for him is trusting himself and believing that he can do these things. And I am so glad that we did this, that we were able to do this test to find this out about him so that he could get that diagnosis, so that now we can kind of support him knowing that. At the same time, I find it makes me want to protect him more. It's very conflicting. I feel very conflicted.
It's so true. I mean, when you see your child as more vulnerable because they have anxiety, because they have ADHD, because they have whatever, the instinct is to protect them. It just is. And I think that the research on autonomy supportive care is interesting because it doesn't say, oh, it's a free for all, just go out, they should do their own thing. This is research by Wendy Grolnick at Clark University, who found that when kids are in transitions, when they're doing something new, they're moving from elementary school to middle school, when they're whatever the new thing is, that they need more guardrails. We need to make sure that they're safe and that we're taking care of them. But as they learn that, then we need to be able to give them more say. So it's a, like everything in life, it's a balance of some protection and yet not, but not seeing your child as vulnerable. I think that that's the mindset shift, seeing your child as capable is something that's so critical for any parent with, and I know because we have it in our family too, kids with ADHD. My son was not diagnosed with ADHD, but he was not an easy kid in school growing up. And I feel like the biggest gift that I gave him in school was to never let anyone put him in a narrow box. He was real creative. He was real energetic. And not to see him in negative ways was just so important to me. And I really do feel ultimately that I would not allow it. And I was glad. I mean, I wouldn't let his grandparents do it. When he messed up their house, I wouldn't let his, you know, they had to deal constructively with him. I moved teachers once with him when a teacher was very controlling and didn't like his exuberance. You know, I just was a mama bear about that. On the other hand, he did grow up feeling good about himself. And so I think that you can help your son in all these little ways, see his strengths. And it's a matter of giving real-time feedback, not, oh, you're so wonderful, because we all know that that makes kids feel inadequate. Yeah. Like, I'm really not that wonderful. What yeah. Do they have any taste? but helping them see their competencies, where that homework was really hard and you stuck to it and you did it. And I know you would have preferred video games, you know, whatever it is, real-time feedback that but helps you flip the switch and see the strengths.
Well, that makes me feel better. Yeah, and it's funny too, because if I look back at myself, I know, I mean, he is a carbon copy of me, and I know that if I had been diagnosed with anything, that's exactly how I would have been diagnosed. And here I am, and I survived, and I got through it. So I need to trust here. I need to trust that. I need to trust him, and I need to trust myself.
So. Well, and you're a good, that in that way, you're a good role model for him.
Yeah.
Because you're a very competent, you know, accomplished professional. And you can say, you know, I had this struggle and that struggle, but, you know, I did it.
So that conversation that we had right there reminds me of something that that we talked a little bit about the other day that I would love for you to expand on a little bit, is how someone said to you that The Breakthrough Years is almost a book on how we can reparent ourselves. And so I just was wondering if you could share anything that you've heard from other parents or other people that have kind of shared that experience and learned about themselves by reading this book.
The story you just told me is a wonderful example. Honestly, hadn't thought of The Breakthrough Years as a journey to reparent ourselves. But I have a colleague named Susan who said that when she read it, she had miserable teenage years, and it helped her reparent herself to see who she could have been and give herself what she needed to now be the person she wants to be. And it just wasn't something that you know, that's what's so wonderful about books, because they're really a conversation. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're on a page, yes, but they're really a conversation that you have with the ideas in the book, with the author, with all of the people in the book. And this was a conversation that I didn't really realize. And I just love that. I think it's really an important idea, because adolescence is a time when we have to reparent ourselves, because they're not going to always be with us. And we suddenly know that. We don't know that really when they're little kids. You know, we think of right. Always be changing diapers.
Yes.
They will always be up all night. They will always be, you know, falling apart at the grocery store, whatever is, you know, our joy in life. And suddenly we know, you know, with you have a 15-year-old, you know that in 3 years or 4 years, they're, you know, probably going to go to college or move out in a different direction. So when I did the book on the six stages of parenthood, I found that it was a time of adolescents figuring out who they are, but it's a time of parents figuring out who we are and who we want to be, not just as a parent, but as an adult now with someday to be grown children. And we can see that horizon in a way that we couldn't when they were little. So reparenting ourselves, they're seeking their identity, are seeking our new identity, because it is a new identity. We're more than a parent person, even if we've had a career, you know, that's been very meaningful to us. Still, a big part of our identity as parents is wrapped up in that role. So it's just wonderful. And you're saying that you could see yourself in who your child is and how your life could have been different if it had been different for you, so that you can give that difference to your child and to yourself. I think it's just a very incredibly profound and moving experience. And if that's, you're telling me that is a gift, so thank you.
Yeah, I mean it's true, and it really caught me off guard at how validated, simultaneously validated my teen self felt and my present self feels. Just being able to look at myself as a teenager with this perspective, after having learned this perspective, I felt like I can go back and really forgive myself for a lot of the things that I have looked back on with maybe shame. And now I feel like I can explain it to myself. And I can also look back on the relationship that I had with my parents, especially my dad. My dad and I fought a lot. And I can look back at his even all the way back to his childhood, and it validates so much for my experience with him when I was a teenager. And to think about all of that, I don't even know what word to use other than validating, but it's more than that. It's much deeper than that. And I mean, this is going to sound totally cheesy and like an extreme, but it's true. I will be eternally grateful to you, Ellen, for this book. And also last year, having that ADHD diagnosis for myself, like those two together. I didn't want to cry. It's true, though. It's true. It's just really impactful for me. So thank you.
Wow. Well, that's a gift you've given me. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I couldn't have hoped for more, ever. That's the joy of being a research adventurer, that you don't know what you're going to find. You just don't know. It's just, you turn a vista and there's a treasure.
I'd love to talk about chapter four. We are trying to understand ourselves and our needs. I just loved that chapter so much.
I had been reading a lot about the so-called mismatch between the development of kids' brains, that turns out not to be such an accurate depiction. But at that point, I was really trying very hard to understand what was accurate, what the science really said, to go as deep as I could. And I met with a researcher who was originally from Australia, Nick Allen, from the University of Oregon. And w I was sounding off my, he'd written papers about this theory, and I was sounding off my views, listening to his views. And suddenly I had this aha moment where I thought the mismatch is actually not in the development of the brain. It's in the experiences that we give teenagers, young people, and what they need. And it was that word need that was my aha. Because when you look at when the adolescent brain is most activated, when it is more activated than with little children or younger children, and when it is more activated than a little bit older adults, you start to see patterns in this activation. When they're treated with respect is one, or not respect. When they are rejected or excluded, or don't feel that they belong is another experience like that. When they are made to feel incompetent versus competent, or not challenged versus challenged, or when they can't be who they are, or when they don't contribute, those kinds of experiences. And I went, oh my gosh. That's the mismatch. It's between what children need and the experiences that we're giving to them. So I at that point knew self-determination theory. This is DC and Ryan at the University of Rochester, where the notion is that we don't just have physical needs for food, for water, for shelter. We have psychological needs, and in their case, relatedness, autonomy, and competence. Those are the three needs that they say are basic psychological needs. But what I could do was to go to the research on brain development, which was new, you know, which happened after some of these theories were being developed, and look at where adolescents' brains seem to be more activated than other times, and match it up with self-determination theory, with other theories. So came up with a way of looking at five basic psychological needs. And those are the needs for caring connections, which would be their relatedness, but I include belonging and also the you've got my back, you know, feeling supported, that is so important to young people. Two is the need for agency, which is both autonomy, having some autonomy, that is you have some control over what happens to you, and being treated with respect. And their whole papers, you know, Ron Dahl, Dave Yeager, other people have written whole papers on adolescents' need to be treated with respect, and interventions or ways of working with them that don't treat them with respect don't actually work and can be harmful, in fact, not just don't work, but can produce the unintended or opposite effect. And so that was this, that's the second need. And the third need is, I call it mastery, but it includes their competence, but also challenge. You think of that sense of flow that we have when we are doing something hard, there's almost no greater experience, and we actually do it, and then time disappears, and we're just in a flow. I can feel that way when I'm writing, and I suddenly, things just fall, start, you know, you're almost on, you know, you don't even know where all this is coming from, and you're just going. And the next need, and this is so important to teenagers, is being able to figure out and be who you are, identity. So when you feel like you can't be who you are, you're compromising yourself in some way, you know, that's a pretty negative experience in all of, you know, throughout our development, but particularly in adolescence. And then the fifth one is purpose. I call it purpose, but with a small p. It's not like you have to find your purpose in life. We're not going to do that as adolescents. We're probably going to have the seeds of it, but we're not, you know, that's a journey in life, not just when we're an adolescent. But so finding things that are meaningful would be the way that I'd put purpose. And then finding ways that you can give back, contributing. So those are my five needs that I think are so important. And I could test this in the study that I did. So immediately, you know, researcher go, whoa, let's see. Look at the match or mismatch between the experiences that we give young people and the environment provides and how they're doing. So I asked them about all of these needs, you know, to what extent does in the last month, you know, has your family made you feel, or your friends made you feel, or the people at school, or the people in out of school activities, or the people you meet online made you feel, and that you belong, or that they care about you, that they'll help you when you need help, that you can be who you are, you know, those sorts of experiences. Now that can sound a little like coddling, and it's not coddling. I mean, I think first of all, if we've been in an experience where we haven't belonged lately, if we're just swimming along and we're in lots of experiences now as adults where we belong, we forget how powerful it can feel not to belong. And I think it's like moving to a new place, going to a new job. For adults, it takes that jarring experience to make us remember how important belonging is. But that goes along. These experiences can have a yin yang. It's what the environment provides. It's what the people in our lives do for us. But the, you know, take competence. They can help us feel that we're competent, but also push us, challenge us. So it's not just, you know, we can figure out who we are, but we give back to others. There's a yin yang there. It's not coddling at all. It's really about the foundation we need to thrive. So I tested it in the study. I asked young people these questions, and I found that okay, so then I could correlate it with what was happening right then. And the correlations were, you know, really powerful. But then the pandemic happened, and I had a chance to go back and do the study again. And so I looked at how they felt 9 months before. Now we're in the midst of the pandemic, 9 months before the pandemic hadn't happened, and whether those psychological needs were met, those basic psychological needs were met, and how they were doing in the pandemic. And it just, you know, blew my mind, because it was we controlled for everything we could control for statistically. Again, it's correlational, so it's not causal.
Right.
But you can see that even at the 0.0005 level, which is a high level of probability, that kids who were environments where their basic psychological needs were met were more likely to thrive during the pandemic. This is the foundation upon which we thrive.
Wow. What I really related to when I was reading that chapter, which the chapter four, which I really loved that whole section. It really spoke to me as a coach because I feel like so much of what we do as coaches when we work with adolescents and young adults is all of that. It's all of that and supporting them exactly where they are, meeting them where they are, and giving them these tools and strategies that they can learn so that they can, make connections with their professors or their friends or their teachers and, have agency and feel respected when they're in school and different environments. And just really spoke deeply to me.
And the yin and yang of that is that we need environments that meet our basic psychological needs, but we need the kinds of skills, these executive function in my view, skills, based skills that help us then take control of our lives. So we need environments that can help us feel that we have some say over our life, but then we need the skills to take on challenges. So it's again not coddling in any way, shape, or form. This is giving kids and ourselves too the skills we need to thrive in life.
Yeah, and speaking of those skills, I mean, just in the very next chapter, which maybe that was intentional, you have
It
them
was.
coming next to each other. Yeah,
It
but
was.
those, I loved that chat. The last chapter was so fun to read. There's so many listeners. You have to read this book, of course, and we know that. And but chapter five is just full of different ideas for developing these skills, and everything in there was so accessible and fun and interesting. So,
Well, I'm a former teacher, as a teacher, a parent, I'm a grandparent. I don't really want research. Research isn't always done to tell us what to do and shouldn't be. But there are real lessons from the research that we can apply in our lives. I call them suggestions. I don't call them, you have to do this. These are things that you can try. But there's so much information from the research about how we can use this. I thought of it as this is news you can use, research that you can use to have a life that you want to have as a parent, as a kid, as an adult in your workplace, wherever you are.
Yeah, I love that. So, maybe before we go, could you share maybe one of your favorite stories from the book? A little bit about one of, I mean, if you can even pick one.
I'll tell the story of a researcher and then the story of his research. Jason Akonifua is at Berkeley, and he grew up, he's black, he grew up in Memphis, and his family moved a lot, and he went to different schools. And he, so he could see that the farther out in the suburbs he was, the better he was treated as a black kid, and the further in the city he was, the more the negative assumptions about him. This all came to a head when he was taking calculus, and he was in the cafeteria, and he got handed a flyer, and the flyer was an invitation to a party, but it had some swearing on it, and the assistant principal came up and told all of the kids that they were going to get suspended. And he hadn't even read the flyer. So he didn't feel, the teenage sense of justice. He just wasn't right. And he said his mother would support him. So he got called into the office and she said, "Will you sign this paper?" And I'm not advocating that he should have done this, because you could really end up in jail for this. And he almost did. But he said no, he wouldn't sign it. And then she gave him 2 day suspension and he really didn't want to miss calculus. And so he said no, he wasn't going to sign it. He wanted to go back to school. He wasn't one of those kinds of kids. He wanted to go back to school. And then they gave him the police came and got him and took him to court. And because he had such good grades in calculus, and the judge said, "Are these your grades?" They were. He said, "Get out of here and tell your school never to send you back." He got picked up by a Rotary group in his hometown, and sent to a private school where he suddenly had a very different experience. And that made it clear to that the environments that we're in make such a difference. And so he always wanted to study that, and he created an intervention about treating kids with respect during discipline, when they're being disciplined. So he calls it empathy. I would also argue that it was also respect, around one of the basic needs we have. And they did one of these mindset interventions where they, with mindset interventions, they're very short interventions. They last about an hour, but the teachers were given it. They worked with teachers in, I think, 51 teachers, if I'm remembering. They were math teachers in three districts in California, and they were given an intervention to look at how being treated well, even if you're disciplining a child, could make a difference in how they respond. And they were they read research on it, and then they read teachers' reports, students' reports about how being treated without respect or with respect made a difference. And finally, there's this part called saying is believing, where you then do it. You write a letter to other teachers about how important it is. It doesn't mean you don't have rules. You have the rules, but you treat kids with respect with the rules. It's kind of the opposite of zero tolerance, where you're assuming they're bad kids. You're assuming they're good kids. And this intervention cut the suspension rates in half in these districts. You know, it just was an example of how his lived experience, how his experience of being treated with and without respect, both in living in different places and then in going to a boarding school where he was, where his sense of debating was seen as an asset. You know, he was considered a good debater, made the debate club, you know, rather than being a surly, obnoxious kid. It was like, this is a talent, we'll nurture it. You know, he was lucky, but his luck turned out to be our gift, because he could give back this research that can help us handle discipline problems in education and parenting in a very different way. If we treat kids, even when we're disciplining them, with autonomy and respect, we're going to get a very different result.
Yeah, and the theme throughout your book is changing our perspective on things. So there's changing our perspective on teens and adolescents. And the good outcomes that can come of that. And what a beautiful example of that.
Yeah, I love that story. When Jason, I heard him speak, I asked him if I could go interview him. And I had no idea that was his story, you know. But each researcher told me a wonderful story. So in the book are the stories of each of us, you know, research is me search. Each of us studies something that matters to us personally. And hopefully tries to make the world a better place through the work that we do. And so I share those, not just the research, you know, how people know what they know about teenagers, because I think it's important not just to say this is what teenagers are like, but why this person is doing this kind of research and the difference that they hope it'll make. So I share the actual, how they do their studies, not just that they do their studies.
Yeah. Oh, you did a great job.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
And so where can people find you? Your book is coming out soon. It's going to be released on
March 26th.
March 26th.
A month from yesterday.
That's great. That's very exciting. And do you have a website?
I do. All these years of writing books, I've never had my own personal website. I've always had a website around the subject, but not around me. But this time I was prevailed upon to have an ellengalinsky.com website where my books will live. We'll also have it at my nonprofit through the breakthrough years. And then I'm working with AASA, which is a school superintendent organization, to translate these ideas. We're going to work with teachers in a civic science way and educational leaders and superintendents to create training and tools to begin to implement these ideas in the educational system around the country, because we know, for example, that executive function skills are so critical to success. We need to do more. And I'm devoting my time now and my research to being able to work with educators to create practical tools and training and materials that will help us share these ideas and help. Hopefully we'll have better lives as teachers and parents, and our kids will have better lives as teenagers.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen. I am so excited for the breakthrough years to be brought to the world. Our teens need us to thrive. So I hope the lessons we can learn from Ellen's research reach parents, educators, and caregivers far and wide. If you do pick up a copy, don't be alarmed by the length. Yeah, it's a long book, but I found it to be written and organized in a way that's not overwhelming. It's broken down into manageable chunks, just like we always recommend when tackling something big. There are charts and graphics to keep it visually interesting, and the content is so compelling that you'll find yourself breezing right through it. And it's a book you can keep coming back to, finding the section you need that day and learning something new from it, even if you're reading it again. As always, if you have questions or topic suggestions, you can reach out to me at podcast@beyondbooksmart.com. Leave us a review on Apple or Spotify, and we'll love you forever. Please subscribe to Focus Forward on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can sign up for our subscriber email at beyondbooksmart.com/podcasts. Our talented producer and editor is Sean Potts. Our newly engaged content marketer is Justice Abbott. And many, many thanks to Ellen Galinsky for this and every other conversation, and to Jessica Zagacki for connecting me with her. I also want to thank Beyond Booksmart CEO Michael Dellman for continuing to support me and the work we're doing here at Focus Forward. Thanks for listening.